Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Over the weekend, President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy reached an agreement on raising the debt ceiling and postponing any repeat of having to deal with it again until after the 2024 election. But many congressional Democrats and Republicans are unhappy with the deal, and its fate is in their hands. Democrats are upset that the president entered into negotiations with Republicans after saying that he wouldn't, and because they believe he was held hostage by extremists on the right. Republicans don't think they got enough from these negotiations, and many apparently see no problem with defaulting on our debt. Congress now has until next Monday to approve the deal, or we are highly likely to go into default, which would send the world economy, well, we don't know exactly where it would send it because it's never happened before. But most predict dire consequences worldwide. A stock market crash, a dramatic rise in interest rates, and a loss of trust in the dollar and in the government of the United States. We are only one of two countries with a fixed debt ceiling. And the head of the World Monetary Fund says it's time we rid ourselves of it. So why don't we? Why do we repeat this walk to the edge of the abyss time and time again? How will the deal reached this weekend affect us if Congress passes it? What will really happen if they don't and time runs out? Many questions to be answered this hour, and to help us, we're joined by Mark Vittner, chief economist at Piedmont Crescent Capital and former senior economist at Wells Fargo. Welcome back to the program. Good morning.
Good to be back with you.
We have two economists here. Dr. John Connaughton is with us. He's the director of the UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast. Good morning to you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
And because this is also a political issue, Dr. Michael Bitzer joins us. He's a professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Good to see you again.
Good to see you as well.
And let me start with you. Everybody's been talking for weeks about what might happen if we default, and we will talk about that too. But first, explain to me why we are one of two nations in the world, Denmark being the other one, that have this fixed debt ceiling. What is its purpose? Why do we have it? Is it ensconced in law? And what do other countries, how do they function without it?
Well, Congress has the power to determine how much government spending is done. So it's really part of the congressional appropriations spending mechanism. We have always had debt with the U.S. Federal government. In fact, some argue that part of our constitutional republic was due to the United States government pledging to take on the Revolutionary War debt of the states and basically deal with that issue. So we have had debt throughout the history of our government. And it's really, you know, a process by which we acknowledge that sometimes the government spends more money than it takes in. And so using this kind of deficit spending allows the government to fulfill a lot of its public policy obligations. You know, so much of what government does is funded through money, through spending. And so this is part of just the normal governmental process. Oftentimes, these kinds of showdowns are really kind of brinksmanship in political dynamics. One side wants something, the other side wants something, and they come to loggerheads until the final moment. And this is oftentimes the strategy that they play themselves into.
And because this causes concern, Michael, that is exactly why the head of the International Monetary Fund has said the time has come for the United States to rid itself of this arbitrary debt ceiling. And in fact, we could, even though it might be somewhat politically difficult, because doing so would be seen as kind of a gateway to additional deficit spending. And in fact, for about a decade and a half, Congress declared necessary borrowing was automatically authorized when spending is approved, meaning that they didn't have a debt ceiling. Why did we move away from that?
Well, again, it was an attempt to try and rein in the federal budget. That was known as the Gephardt rule. And that kind of set the tone for quite a while. But as the debt continued to escalate because of budget deficits, they went back to this process of setting limits and sometimes suspending the debt ceiling limit until a certain point in the future. And that's what we've got this time. It will be suspended until after the 2024 election, give everybody kind of breathing room and deal with it come January of 2025. In terms of what other countries do, I'll defer to my economist colleagues on that, because I'm more of an Americanist than necessarily an internationalist. But I believe Denmark is the only other country that has this kind of fixed number. Everybody else, I believe, does it by percentage, I think, of their GDP. And others can correct me if I'm wrong on that.
John Connaughton, raising the debt ceiling is not about spending more money. It's about paying bills due for money already spent by the government. Some may believe that it is runaway spending by Democrats and President Biden that is to blame for this. But I am told by everything I've read that that is not the case. So what is?
Well, I'm glad you were told that, Mike. It's probably not true. I think that there are a couple of things here that I think we need to fix the record up a little bit. So let me go ahead and, other countries don't run 130% of their GDP in debt. And that's where we are right now and rising. And if you look at the CBO projections, the May CBO projections, Congressional Budget Office, and they are nonpartisan, they're pretty reliable. Over the next 10 years, by 2033, we're going to have a debt of about a deficit of $2.8 trillion. And each year we're adding somewhere between $1.5 and $2.8 trillion to our accumulated debt. To put it in perspective, Mike, right now we're paying about 10% of what we spend on interest to support that debt. So we're only, when we take tax revenue and borrowing in, we're only able to spend 90 cents of every dollar on programs and issues.
When you're talking about trillions of dollars, it's hard for people to wrap their heads around.
I'm going to give you percentages, Mike.
Well, hold it. Put this into perspective. If our debt is 130% of what we take in.
No.
Say it again.
130% of our GDP.
Okay. So put that into ordinary language. As a wage earner, if we had something comparable to that in our personal budgets, what would it mean?
Well, it would mean that you owe essentially 130% of what you produce every year.
And don't people do that? If you own a home, if you own several cars,
yeah, but
you
there's one big difference, Mike.
Okay, all right.
We are finite, all of us, and we go in the same way we go out.
With nothing.
Yeah, with nothing. So let me go back to what I'm talking about here and why this is critical. As I said, right now, for every dollar that we take in revenue and every dollar that we borrow, we get to actually spend 90 cents of that on programs, et cetera, benefits, so forth. If the CBO is correct, in 10 years, we'll only be able to spend 85 cents on programs and benefits. So in other words, the accumulation of debt over time, as it gets a bit bigger and bigger and bigger percent, means that you're spending much, much more of what's available to you for programs and benefits on just servicing that debt. And that's where the problem arises. And that's why this is an important, I think it's a critical point in time about what we do with our government and what we do in terms of government expenditures. If you would have this conversation like 10 years ago, I wouldn't have cared one way or the other about it. But this isn't 10 years ago, this is now, and we're starting to get to a point where it's starting to become a burden.
It's beginning to be real money.
It's getting to be costly in terms of what the government can do in terms of programs and in terms of benefits.
Mark Vittner, we've already seen the stock market, I guess, maybe preparing for the inevitable here, or what appears maybe the inevitable. The stocks have been up and down, and you've watching your 401k rise and fall over the last several months. And that's probably because of the shenanigans that they're anticipating going forward this week until June the 5th. But what does the mere presence of our having a debt ceiling do to the investment world? Did they see it as a plus? Do they see it as a minus? How do they view it?
Yeah, I think the bond market probably sees it as a somewhat of a plus over the long run, and that yield interest rates are probably lower over the long run because we have a debt ceiling. Because the budget deals with what we plan to spend. And the hard, cold reality is we always spend more than we plan to. And so the debt ceiling is, hey, we spent this much more than we thought we would. We got to do something about it. And so that's one of the reasons that we have that. And the other reason that I think we have it, and I don't care if Denmark has it, hardly any other country or no other country really has it to the effect that we do, we're the world's reserve currency. And if we continue to run our debts to a point that interest costs go parabolic, meaning that they're increasing dramatically and crowding out our ability to spend on everything else, then that really puts that at risk. And so I think that's the critical issue here. And for the stocks, they're very uncertain, because for the stock market, stock investors are concerned that they were going to see some sort of very harsh constraints put on government spending, which I really don't think we're going to do. The deal that they have doesn't do that at all. It's a very minor cuts in spending. But I think that the uncertainty of what happens if we go past the deadline, if we have a downgrade, which is possible, even if we do pass this, that we get a downgrade, all of that is in the back of stock investors' minds. The overall markets look pretty good because of this AI little boomlet that we're seeing right now. And there's six stocks that have gone up dramatically, and that's made the overall averages look pretty good.
You mentioned unplanned expenses. We have a budget, but there are always things that in everybody's budget that go unplanned. But not everybody funds two unfunded wars, three recessions, a global pandemic, and three rounds of tax cuts. All of that has come in the last several years, and it's all been off budget. Is that sustainable?
It's not. But I can tell you that in the last year, the biggest upside surprise has really been from the Inflation Reduction Act, in that we have these, all of these incentives for electric vehicles and all sorts of things that are very well intended, but they were very narrowly implemented originally, and then everybody screamed and cried out, and so we broadened them. As we broadened them, we wound up spending a lot more money in year one than we thought we would. The same holds true for the CHIPS Act, and that these things have proven to be much more expensive in their first year than we thought, because originally we didn't think we were going to hit the debt ceiling till much later this year. We've hit it much earlier.
Wow. Whenever we reach this debt ceiling conversation, it seems like a game of chicken with one side playing against the other until the very last possible minute when they reach a deal. This time the stakes appear to be higher, with Republicans, particularly Republicans, being very unhappy with this, and particularly those in the Tea Party movement or the Liberty, whatever, the Freedom Caucus, thinking that they're not getting what they need to reduce this deficit, and people on the left saying, well, you've given away the store, we've been held hostage. Is this just the same old story on steroids, or is there something more to this time, Mark?
It is a little bit of the same old story, in that you're going to hear from the Congressional Budget Office that this is going to save an immense amount of money over the next 10 years. But in reality, the deal only covers the next 2 years. And because we increased spending by 10% last year, the base that which we're starting at is so high that it's a 0.9% cut in spending off that base. We're still going to spend more money in fiscal 2024 than we did last year. So that's the bottom line. So they shouldn't be that upset.
Mark Bittner is chief economist with Piedmont Crescent Capital. He's here with John Connaughton with UNC Charlotte and Michael Bitzer from Catawba College. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the debt ceiling. We have to have an agreement on it, we are told, by the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. By Monday of next week, it is now in the hands of Congress after the Speaker of the House and the President reached an agreement over the weekend. Neither side likes it. We're about to see what happens. Mark Bittner is here. He's chief economist with Piedmont Crescent Capital. John Connaughton is director of the UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast. And Michael Bitzer is professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, has warned of, these are her words, catastrophe, if Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling. Annahel Husky, who was going to be with us this morning and had to cancel, but who writes about economics and economic impact on consumers for NerdWallet, reports the White House Council of Economic Advisors warned in 2021 of worldwide recession, worldwide frozen credit markets, plunging stock markets, and mass worldwide layoffs were this to happen. Mark, do you agree with that?
I think that's probably a little bit of an overstatement, but it would be very disruptive. I mean, I think that the stock market would be extremely volatile. We'd probably see big intraday swings. I think it really would begin to call into question our status as the world's reserve currency. It wouldn't wipe it out because there's nothing there to replace us right now. But we've got to get our act in order. And that includes coming up with a credible plan to reduce the trajectory on our deficits. And that's something that has to come home. And I think the center of both parties is working toward that. And the fact that both extremes, the extreme left and the extreme right, are screaming the loudest right now, tells me that we're taking a step forward on that. So I think this is a small step in the right direction, but getting folks to work together in Washington has been something that we haven't done in years. And this is really the first time that we've gotten that.
Let me get your take on this, John, because I read yesterday that some people are saying that if we default on Monday, we don't pass the debt ceiling legislation, and this drags on for a while as they argue out what to do, that we are facing, quote, fire and brimstone Armageddon level global financial crisis. That seems terrible. Is it possible?
You might want to talk to Michael about this. This is sometimes when politicians, what is it they say, Mike? How do you tell when a politician is lying? His lips are moving? Mm-hmm. This is a situation. This is way out of control. Let's back up for a second. Two things I want to mention. Number one, we went through this in 2011, and Obama and Boehner, who was the Speaker of the House at the time, got together one weekend and they hashed it out and they agreed to the grand bargain, which of course never happened because Mr. Harry Reid decided that he was not going to deliver the Senate to President Obama at the time on that deal. And we got right up to the brink again, and we basically managed to get through it. That's number one. So this is not like, oh my God, this has never happened before. This has happened several times, and it's been quite exasperating and right up to the brink. I think 2011 was a lot worse than it was right now for a variety of reasons. Michael can explain the politic dynamic of what was taking place in 2011 better than I can. But the second thing is this whole idea that somehow or other, if the debt ceiling is not passed by some date that seems to change every about hour and 20 minutes or so, that we're going to default. Now, let me be clear about this. Default is a choice not to pay the service on your debt. We have the wherewithal to pay our debt interest without question. So let me give you a simple analogy. Suppose Mike, you probably have a distant cousin who makes $100 a week and spends $110 a week every week, right? And they put that extra $10 on their credit card. And after about 20 or so weeks, they hit the $200 credit card limit. And the bank says, no mas, no more. That's it, son. And they're still pulling $100. Now I got to decide what $10 are they going to cut? Now they may choose not to pay their mortgage. They may choose not to pay their car payment. They may also choose not to have the latte at Starbucks. Okay, so the choice, we are bringing in 77 cents in tax revenue every single day for every dollar that we spend. So we're going to have to make some choices. We're still going to have money to pay some of the obligations that we have. We have to make choices. And my bet is we will pay the interest on our debt, number one. We'll pay Social Security. But some of the hospitals might not get their Medicare payments on or Medicaid payments on time. Some workers in the federal government will get furloughed. This is just like when we don't have a government budget, the government shuts down for a few days. This has happened frequently in the last couple of decades. So this idea that somehow or other we're going to default on our debt is a choice that would be made. It's not a Lewis F. Harrelson guarantee for those.
But this is not like the government shutdowns that we've been through. This is not the same thing.
It is. It is in a similar way. Yeah. You still have money coming in. Today, there are checks being written by companies and individuals to the government to pay their taxes. And there will be tomorrow and so on. And we're getting about, we take in revenue about 77 cents of every dollar that we spend. And we can choose how to spend that 77 cents. And if we choose not to pay the interest on our debt, that's a choice that we make. And one other thing, someone might bring up, what about debt that comes due? We don't have the capital pay. Within the provisions, we can roll over without affecting the debt ceiling. By the way, we hit the debt ceiling in January, by the way, $31.4 trillion. We've been going on without the debt ceiling being raised for the last 4.5 months.
But if as a consumer, I decide, well, I'm not going to pay my mortgage anymore. I'm not going to pay my credit card debt. I'm not going to make my car payment. Not only would I go into default, they'd repossess the car. The bank mm-hmm. would take the house. And I would be out on the street and I would essentially be bankrupt and unable to get credit. What happens when a country does that?
But Mike, you made that choice. And what I'm telling you is that's not the choice we'll make with that 77 cents out of every dollar that we spend. We'll cut 23 cents for sure, but we'll cut it in other areas, right? But that's the point I'm trying to make.
Michael, you're right. There's a consequence. If we do prioritize what we decide to pay, so if we move past the deadline and we can't pay all our bills and we just service the debt, but we cut spending somewhere else, I think that bondholders would still view that as a default and our credit rating would probably be downgraded almost instantly, because that's what would happen with any other borrower that wasn't paying their bills. They were less creditworthy.
And Mark, some say that the damage, if we were to go into default, the damage would not be temporary. It would be permanent. Do you agree?
It would certainly be long lasting. I mean, permanent is a long time, but it would certainly be long lasting. I will add one other thing, though, and that is that given the inflation that we've seen, some more of your more free market economists would say that we've already defaulted, that we defaulted because we inflated the currency. We grew the money supply by 25% to monetize the debt. And so we're paying everybody with cheaper dollars. In fact, it's not just the far right conservative economists, they would be actually be called the liberals in the old liberals wing, but it is also our adversaries that are using that. The Chinese are putting out a lot of propaganda about that.
So, Michael, since this has never happened before, we don't really know everything that might happen because there's no way to predict it beyond a shadow of a doubt. But do you believe that ideologues on either side of the aisle care about public reaction either here or elsewhere around the world? Or are they so dug in that they would see voting no as a victory?
I think certainly the polarization effect that we are at the height of in recent times is certainly going to drive a lot of this. And I think you will see folks on both sides of the political aisle, as particularly John has mentioned, the extremist really rail against this particular deal. The center will come together. It'll probably be a true bipartisan agreement on this particular vote. But the policy stances that both sides have been driven further into their corners over, Republicans will not raise taxes and Democrats are loath to cut spending. And in particularly when you're talking about such a small sliver of discretionary spending, spending that Congress can determine from year to year, as opposed to the mandatory kind of spending, as John indicated, payments on the interest, payment for Social Security. People are loath to cut defense spending. So where are we going to get these cuts from when it's a smaller and smaller percentage? And the extremes, the both sides of the political ideology spectrum are not going to budge necessarily on where they see their dynamics, their oxes getting gored.
So Dennis emails us, why not legislate a debt to GDP percentage that's fixed and manageable? John, would that work?
Well, it might have worked a few decades ago, but today we're pretty much past that. I mean, essentially, I mean, Japan runs a 200% debt to GDP ratio, and they have for quite some time, and they seem to be fine with it. But again, you know, the culture there's a little different in terms of Japanese being willing to hold a debt at very, very low rates. And so it's not a very costly thing to them. But in our case, it is very costly. And as I said, we're already way past that 100% mark. And we're up there in pretty shallow company. There are only a few other countries like Italy and Japan who run debt to GDP ratios as high as we are. But I would certainly not be uncomfortable with 100% and work our way toward that over the next couple of decades. But again, you know, we have to remember, if we go back a decade or so, we were at the 60% range. We were kind of in that mainstream with all the rest of those countries that don't have to raise debt ceilings, but do have a debt to GDP kind of concept. And partly because of COVID, but partly for other reasons as well. It has gotten out of hand in the last decade. It really has. And if you look at the trends of revenue and expenditures, they've been trending along pretty stably, except for ups and downs during recessions, pretty stable over the last three decades until COVID hit. And then spending took off. And when it took off, it never came back. So as you know, Mike, we did 5.5 to 6 trillion of authorizations for COVID in three separate acts. And then as soon as that was done, we followed with the deficit reduction, Inflation Reduction Act, the infrastructure, and then the CHIPS Act. All of them claim to be funded, but as Mark mentioned, they weren't necessarily that well funded, and certainly there was a lot of more upfront spending than was expected in those bills. That's where we are right now, and there doesn't seem to be any turnaround in terms of that difference. Revenues are still going up, but not as fast as expenditures.
Michael, we go through this at regular intervals. You could almost put it on the calendar like a national holiday, because we're going to go through it again. And with this agreement that Mr. McCarthy and Mr. Biden have come up with, we will face it again, but it'll be delayed a little bit after the 2024 election cycle. But why? The 14th Amendment says, and I quote, "The validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned." What law says we have to constantly raise the debt ceiling? Isn't that in violation of the Constitution? It shall not be questioned. We're going to pay these debts, period, end, full stop, full stop.
Yeah, and I think you've heard, as the lead up to this ultimate agreement, you heard more and more chatter about the 14th Amendment being, you know, basically the last draw that Biden could pull out. Now, the question becomes, you know, how will we interpret those words? And shall seems pretty definitive, but in this day and age, we could have litigation over that dynamic. And that's something I think that would prolong the uncertainty, as Mark, you know, talked about, that would rattle the markets. So, you know, 14th Amendment could be pulled out at some time, but, you know, it is a dangerous card to play at this point until we get some kind of resolution. And we have that resolution, it appears, in hand with this budget deal, at least until January of 2025.
There's one other risk in pulling out the 14th Amendment, and that the 14th Amendment deals with the debt. And so the Supreme Court could rule that, yes, you have to pay the debt. You could not avoid paying the debt, which would in effect put very harsh constraints on all other spending. So it could actually give the Republicans a much greater victory than they've ever sought. And that's one of the risks. And Biden knows that very well, that it given the current makeup of the Supreme Court, it could come back and bite him pretty hard.
Okay. So, Mark, if expenses exceed revenues, the answer is to find a way to increase revenues. That is why people who get a paycheck and can't pay the rent often find a part-time job, so they can pay the rent and afford the iPhone. In all the dire warnings that we've heard about what's about to happen if we approach this debt limit ceiling and don't do anything about it, one topic that I have never heard broached is that of raising taxes to fix this. Why not?
Well, I tell you, in the very short run, the revenue side is real important, because if we see we're going to get tax payments, quarterly tax payments are due in mid-June, and if we don't broach the limit, if Janet Yellen is wrong and we make it to the 15th of June, we'll actually push this whole debate into August. So it is really kind of odd that we've got this short little period here. Either deal with it, don't deal with it, and see what happens, and it may push it all the way to August, which I think would be very bad for the financial markets. I think that would be a worse scenario for the economy overall. In terms of longer term, in terms of revenues, there's only one or two times in history that tax collections have been larger as a share of GDP than they are today. One of them was at the peak of the NASDAQ stock market bubble in the late 1990s, and the other was in World War II. So it's, we're already at historic highs as a share of GDP in terms of tax collections. And my sense is that the volatility in the stock market has probably contributed to the revenues, the surge in revenues that we've seen. And so in the very near term, we're likely to see the revenues move the other way, because it's been a down year for the markets this year, and our tax collections in 2024 are likely to disappoint. There hasn't been any discussion about raising taxes. I would be surprised if there was, as we headed to a presidential election. But our tax system could be modernized, simplified. I would like to see both a minimum and a maximum tax, where there's a limit set at the top and a limit set at the bottom, so that we broaden the tax base. But we have incentives out there for people to make as much money as possible, because that would give us a short-term windfall in tax revenues.
I saw John Connaughton nod in agreement there, so we'll come back and get his impression about taxes and how that helps solve our debt problem in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mark Fittner's with us. He is chief economist with Piedmont Crescent Capital. John Connaughton is director of the UNC Charlotte Economic Forecast. Then Michael Bitzer is a professor of politics and history at Catawba College. We're talking about the debt ceiling and the fact that Congress has until Monday to decide whether or not to raise that debt ceiling. And then we're not sure what, but one of the things I brought up in the last segment was no one is ever talking about raising taxes to fix the debt problem. Mark Fittner said he'd like to see both a ceiling and a floor on taxes, to which I saw John Connaughton nod mildly. But taxes were cut during the Trump administration, John, on the wealthy. At the same time, the debt ceiling was raised twice. There must be a correlation here. Would raising taxes on the rich help in paying our debts and lowering the figure that you talked about earlier?
Well, I hate to disagree with you, Mike. Really? Not.
I'm just asking.
We all talk about, let's raise taxes on the rich, let's raise taxes on the rich, let's raise taxes on the rich. And it's a popular theme, and most people aren't rich, so they say, yeah, what the heck, why not? A couple of corrections. First of all, the Trump tax cut did cut taxes on the rich. It also cut taxes on the middle class. And it also cut taxes on some of the lower income folks as well. So that's number one. Number two, we did not see actually a change in the trend in revenue as a result of the Trump tax cuts. The revenue stream, as I mentioned before, has been fairly consistent over the past three decades in terms of its annual growth, smooth annual growth rate. Obviously, there are some dips, particularly in 2008 and 2009, again in 2020 when COVID hit. There is a dip at that point, but the trend has been fairly consistent in terms of growth. And as Mark mentioned, and I think this is critical, he said that we are at pretty close to an all-time high in the percent of revenue that we collect as a percent of our GDP. And so taxes aren't the issue here. I mentioned this before, we had close to $6 trillion in three acts of close to $6 trillion in additional expenditures and three separate acts passed in less than a year during COVID. All right, we can go through each one of them if you want to, but that was excessive. And then that's followed by Biden's Build Back Smaller or the Inflation Reduction Act, whatever you want to call it, the CHIPS Act, et cetera, the Infrastructure Act. All of these were $1 trillion, not the CHIPS Act, but others were $1 trillion plus expenditures bills. Okay, you can't do that kind of stuff and expect to be able to pay for it. And I know that there were allegations that there were tax increases in those that what they called pay fors. But the Wharton School pretty much debunked that in terms of those pay fors were not consistent for the long term. And as Mark mentioned, I think this is important. The early year expenditures in those bills turned out to be a lot more than was originally estimated. So they've come on much, much quicker. And they're not going away. We know that. These bills are going to be bigger than what they were advertised for over the next 10 years, because those numbers are 10-year numbers in terms of expenditures. And so, you know, those are in place, and we're not going to change those and turn those back. So, you know, this is a problem. And you, for those that are, you know, serious about this, if this is your, this was your household, you'd start to make some spending cuts and start to get your economic house in order, so to speak. This can't go on.
So we live, Michael, in a world where compromise, at least politically, is a dirty word. And evidently the deal that was reached this weekend by President Biden and House Speaker McCarthy was through negotiation, something that the president said he would never do. At least on certain principles, and maybe he didn't cave on certain principles, but what came out of this, would you say, is a compromise, correct?
Yes. I think, you know, if you're alienating the wings on both sides, you've got a compromise.
And many Democrats say they were held hostage by those on the right. Is that hyperbole? Were they held hostage? Because if we hit this debt ceiling on Monday, there all kinds of things might happen. So we got to do something. We got to give them more than we wanted to give them. That's also a compromise, right?
It is. You're not going to get everything you want. And both sides are going to have to put something aside to ultimately get a package that the majority can vote for.
Now, I know that people go to Congress, and we have people like Lauren Boebert say she's going to vote no on this because her constituents did not send her to Congress to vote yes on something like this. But that means that there's no compromise. You get it all or you get nothing at all. Do they know how government works? Not just
well,
her,
I mean,
others.
That's one person.
And, well, not just her, but others. They don't want to compromise on anything anymore.
Well, and that's part of both parties having sorted themselves fairly clearly into their ideological extremes. And the people that scream the loudest oftentimes get the most attention in our, you know, media focused world. So while there's going to be complaints and, you know, screaming from distinct corners, I think if this comes together in a vote, and that there is, you know, more than 218 in the House and probably more than 60 in the Senate, this is a true bipartisan agreement to deal with something.
But Republicans run the risk of being called rhinos, if Republicans in name mm-hmm. only, if they vote for a compromise with Democrats. Do they have the political backbone to risk that?
I guess we'll find out, but I think that the vast majority of Republicans will probably, in both chambers, vote for this.
John.
Yeah, I just quick follow up back to 2011. It was Joe Biden in 2011 who was kind of the center of the negotiations after the grand bargain fell through. So, you know, at the end of the day, this is the Joe Biden that we thought we elected. And, you know, he is a compromiser, and he has always tried to work these things out. And so I'm not surprised at, you know, you say he backed down. I'm not surprised at what he did.
I'm not saying he backed down. I'm saying Democrats say he backed down. Not all Democrats, some.
Well, then they probably haven't paid a lot of attention to Joe over the last 50 years.
Yeah. Mark, a guy named Mark Zandi, a Moody's analytics economist, estimated that a default, if we were to go into default, could kill 7 million jobs in the U.S. economy, and that a deep round of proposed Republican spending cuts would kill 2.6 million jobs. He says this deal that they just reached would cut about 120,000 jobs and raise unemployment by 0.1%. So put those first two scenarios into perspective, if you agree with them, and what this means, this deal might mean for jobs.
Well, Mark's numbers have tended, Mark Zandi's numbers have tended to be rather extreme. And so, and Mark's an interesting character because I think he is a Republican, but he has been overly, I think it's almost as if he's lobbying for a position within the Democratic Party. So he's always provided very, very friendly numbers to them. Certainly if we had a default, it's when you open up that door, you really can't tell what's going to happen. You can't, so you can come up with any kind of scenario that you want. In terms of the budget cuts, here too, you don't know, because if we were to get stricter cuts, and these are very minor, and that spending is probably going to be higher next year than it was this year, because it increased 10% in fiscal 23, 10% increase in spending. So if it's just flat, the base is so high that it'll still be higher in 2024, even with less than 1% cut that's in the deal. If there is some fiscal discipline, the Federal Reserve won't have to raise interest rates as high, and that will neutralize some of the effects, because one of the things that's made inflation so persistent has been the expansive fiscal policy that we've had. So I'm not quite sure that I buy into his numbers. Even the third part, the 120,000 fewer jobs, which is not even statistically significant in a monthly change in employment, something has to be done. I mean, what we don't hear in any of that analysis is what happens if we don't do anything. What happens if we don't do anything? We just raise the debt ceiling as it is. I would think that we would get higher interest rates, and there would be a lot of job loss associated with that.
Michael, since there are so many unknowns with what might happen if we decide not to raise the debt ceiling, and as everybody but some people on this panel have said, we go into default, that seems like a very risky, politically risky thing to do. But Republicans of late have been making politically risky moves or ignoring public opinion on a lot of issues to do what they want to do. Would this be another one?
Well, I think, you know, for Republicans, they have their mantra of what they want to achieve in terms of public policy. And now that they have the U.S. House of Representatives, they have a much more active voice at the table in order to try and achieve them. I think, you know, what's going to be interesting to me is how many Republicans do defect on this particular vote. We've already heard this morning Nancy Mace, who I would say is probably more within the mainstream of Republican Party politics in the U.S. House, came out and said that she's going to vote against it. I don't think you're going to see a wide-scale defection. I don't think you'll see more Democrats voting for it than Republicans necessarily in the U.S. House. But the Republicans have, you know, a very ideological, coherent caucus within the House of Representatives, and they are pretty much agreement on a number of core issues. And for this particular dynamic, you know, government funding is the way to implement programs and policies. And this is kind of the dynamic of the federal budget process. We have become much more policy oriented with the funding of government. And as these issues continue to rise, as Mark and John have argued, this is going to be the effect on government programs going into the future. We're going to have to deal with some serious questions moving forward and deal with the ramifications of those policy decisions.
Speaking of government programs, Republicans, Michael, have suggested time and again reducing spending by cutting programs that benefit the poor. The current deal places work requirements and raises the age of those who receive SNAPs or food stamps. Democrats, of course, want to raise taxes on the rich to solve all of this. Do any polls suggest which way the public thinks is the best course of action?
I'm sure there's probably something out there. I haven't seen it necessarily. I think we will get some public polling on it. Maybe John's got some information on that particular aspect.
Yeah, John? I think that some of the polls that we've seen in terms of the work requirement are pretty high. I've seen some 75 to 80% of American public is support of work requirements for certain types of benefits. So that's not, you know, that's not out of the realm of where people stand. I think another one is I think that the one poll I've seen recently, I could be wrong on this, so I've got to be real careful in terms of crediting it, so I won't mention it, suggested that 60% of American public were in favor of expenditure cuts and reining in the budget deficit. So.
The GAO, Michael, says Congress and the administration need to address the key drivers of the debt and change the government's fiscal path, which is kind of what John Connaughton has been saying. This can't go on. We have to make a change. The GAO also suggests that we should consider alternatives to this debt ceiling by setting a debt limit as part of the budget process and allowing the Treasury to propose a change in the debt limit that would take effect without congressional approval. Is that likely to happen?
I think in divided government, in this current form, I would say probably not. Republicans want to use this to their leverage and get the spending cuts that they want to see imposed. Now, if the shoe was on the other foot and, you know, a Republican president, you know, with a Democratic Congress, maybe that dynamic could play out differently. But I don't see any kind of statutory, you know, reauthorization or delegation of authority from a Republican House to a Democratic administration at this point.
Well, the House controls the purse strings. So that's how the Constitution set it up. But it would seem to me that both parties view this as a cudgel to use against the other.
Mm-hmm.
So you would never.
Sure, it's political brinksmanship. Yeah,
they're not going to cede that power. John, no. The GAO also says that we have no national policy, no guiding roadmap, no guardrails on how much national debt we want to have or how much we believe we can afford to have. That seems remarkably reckless for a country of our size.
You know, we tried to deal with it, Mike. We tried to deal with this a few decades ago with the Simpson-Bowles Commission, and they came up with some recommendations, but because they weren't binding, nothing really happened. And I think it's time that we do something with a much more binding commission, get it out of the realm of politics. I mean, as Michael said, I mean, this is just the extremes kind of rule where both parties are right now. And it's hard. It's hard for the middle in the Democrat Party, and it's hard for the middle in the Republican Party to get together. I don't want to get into the politics of it. I'll let Michael handle that. But I think the idea that if we could get a congressional/presidential commission together of non-politicians to look at this, and as you say, put some guardrails on this and some forward guidance as to where we want to be and one, two, or three decades in terms of our spending as a percent of GDP, I think that's a good idea.
So, Mark, I have about 30 seconds. Is there anything the average person can do, the average investor can do to protect themselves from what might be coming on Monday or afterward if nothing happens?
Well, it's tough to say. It really depends on your risk preferences. I think for more advanced traders, there may be some option strategies to play the volatility because we're likely to have more volatility in the market. And for other people, they just might want to cover their eyes. I mean, because the market will settle down after this, but we could have some ugly days. We've been through it before. We might get through it this time in better shape.
And I would stress for people to
read that GAO report. If you could link it to this story, it's a very short, it's a very readable report.
Okay.
And I think it's very middle of the road.
And finally, if something terrible happens after Monday, Michael, who gets the blame? The Democrats and President Biden or the Republicans and Kevin McCarthy? Quickly.
Yes. Yes. Both. Why not?
Thank you very much. Always definitive. Michael Bitzer, Professor of Politics at Catawba College, John Connaughton, and Mark Vidner.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.